Today's podcast is with Richard Westgate. Richard is a multiple British and world paragliding record holder. He's the ex-winner of the Paragliding XC League. He's a commercial airline pilot, has flown sailplanes, and has many years' experience as a paraglider pilot. Between the 23rd of June and the 21st of July, he's flown 100 kilometres four times. And we're very grateful that he's agreed to talk to us about these flights and share some of the tips on flying 100 kilometres. Richard, tell us a bit about your recent 100k flights. You've done four so far this year, I think, if not more. And how did you? How did you prepare for those kind of flights?
I've been very lucky. I've had a bit of time off work, and I managed to do four 100k flights in a month. And preparation-wise, well, first of all, I've been flying a long time, and it's going to sites that I know I can do 100k from. And that's something I mentally do. I make 100k a goal, something that I've mentally prepared for beforehand. And for most people, that's preparing to spend at least 4 hours in the air. So you really have to give up the whole day to go flying to achieve that. So yeah, the difference this year is I've had the time, and I suppose amassed the experience and over the years to make correct site selections, which in the UK is one of the biggest parts of doing big flights.
Okay, so do you have a specific forecast that you look for, or just, you know, sort of a standard good weather day? Do you actually kind of prepare for your flying in the sense that you actually look for the day and then plan to go out on that day?
We've got so much information available to us now on the internet that it has made that process a lot easier. I use basic synoptics to highlight what might be a good day coming up, but the forecasts have been so random recently, even that's been quite difficult. And then I use RASP to highlight where in the country is the best place to go. And this year I have been prepared to drive from sort of south coast up to Longmindle and Peak Street to be in the right place at the right time. So based on all that information, I'm trying to this year plan where to go the night before and then stick to my plan. My biggest mistake in the past has been to change my ideas halfway through the day, and I've ended up driving in the past 350 miles and doing no flying as I've rushed from site to site. In the UK, often better having a plan, sticking to it, and often the conditions will change on site to make it flyable and give you that window that you're looking for.
So talk us through some of the 100k flights that you've done so far this year.
And the flights I've done in the Longmind during the BPC, from Milk Hill, which is Thames Valley site, up towards Milk Keynes in the southwesterly, and then two flights from a little known site called Lidington near Swindon, down to the coast, one to Brighton and one to Chichester. All quite different days, quite different flights, for various reasons.
Some of them you've done in quite strong winds. I know that the Lidington flights were quite windy days. Tell us about those flights.
Yeah, I don't particularly like flying in strong winds, but the Lidington site is beneficial. It's not a hill you go to in mill winds. It's about the height of a double-decker bus, and your roof has got a better slope on it. But in strong winds, you do get thermals coming off from the large cornfields out in front by the motorway, and the wind allows you to maintain height as you push out and get good climbs. So, bizarrely, it does seem to work in winds over 10 miles an hour very well. So, both flights, the first flight from Lidington down to Brighton, the winds aloft were about 20 kph, and the second flight about 23-24 kph. Actually, that 3-4 kph did seem to make quite a lot of difference to your perceived ground speed. I felt a lot more comfortable on the first flight rather than the second one. I'm the sort of person who always flies clouds rather than ground features, but both flights I actually did get low, and I did notice that the thermal sources and triggers were quite different to what you'd expect on a light wind day. On the first flight, I got very low just past a microflight site called Popham. Just beyond there is a large forest. And I thought, well, the forest is going to have slower moving air go through it, so more likely to heat up. probably quite a good source. And on a light wind day, I'd normally go to the upwind edge, which is where I went to, and I could notice movement in various parts of the forest. So I was bimbing around trying to get up, didn't work, getting lower and lower. I got to a point where I was actually worried about being able to glide clear of the trees. Just managed to stay in the air, and the thermal triggered from the lee of the forest, which is, well, I wasn't really expecting. It did generate then the roughest climb I've been in the UK, and unusually it stayed rough all the way up to 3,000 feet. Halfway through the climb, the guy I'd taken off with and done quite a lot of the flight with came in underneath me, and I think was then very confused as to why I was in this horrible bit of air. My concern at that stage was I was going to fall on him, so wasn't the time to be sharing the air with anybody. Luckily, that was the last tricky bit. Got high there and then managed to get into a really good line of clouds, which took us clear of Farnborough airspace and down the coast of Brighton. The second day, winds on the ground were probably a little bit stronger. And again, it's a little bit like South Africa, where in South Africa, if you go to a ridge, you will sit on it until you get blown over the back of it. And in South Africa, you head for farmhouses, because farmhouses are built on riverbeds or close to water and tend to be in low-lying ground. And when the wind's ripping through at 20-30 kph, the low-lying areas are the only places where the air has a chance to warm up and pool sufficiently to create thermals. So I did notice, getting low a couple times the second day, that it was the low-lying areas that were generating thermals rather than classic triggers. So just something to think about. I think as a generalisation, gliders have just got to a stage where it suits my style of flying. I've always flown quite impatiently, always flown relatively fast, and I think this year, for the first time, with the glider I'm flying has got a 5.5-to-1 glide, it's the best glider I've flown, and it suits my style of flying. I can fly fast, I can miss climbs, I can make the odd mistake, and I stay in the air. Whereas in the past, flying wings with lesser performance, I've always hit the deck at 40-50k. So for the first time, I think we've got gliders you can actually use as gliders rather than parachutes. And my background is from a sort of a sailplaning point of view. My attitude has always been you stay in a 2 up for as long as it takes to get a 3 up for as long as it takes to get a 4 up, and vice versa, and so you continue. So I know other pilots who will stay in any bit of lift. I'd prefer to leave lift early if I can get to where I think I'm going to get a better climb from.
I've seen you kind of dash off, and I have noticed that you like to be moving.
Yeah, I like to see the ground disappearing from under my feet. Yeah, we are very much flying gliders, not parachutes here, so use them as such. The performance we can get out of them now is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, something that I've noticed, the difference between flying cross-country on a hang glider and on a paraglider is that, you know, on a paraglider I've had to really, really work on my patience, because on a hang glider you don't, you know, you can dash off. You know, that's what you do. You get to the top of a climb, you go. You don't really do a lot of the hanging about, drifting.
It's something I always have to work on is patience. Interestingly, on the second flight down to Chichester, I was thinking of following the same route to Brighton, where you get south of the airspace around Petersfield, and then you have to start pushing quite hard to the east to stay on the South Downs and stop hitting the coast too early. And I noticed that the sky had actually gone blue, and instead of the quite deep clouds which are working well we had previously, the only evidence of this lift were quite small, scraggy cumulus. And I made a mental switch to slow down and drift almost due south down the coast rather than trying to extend the flight by pushing further east. And I was actually flying with a guy called Mark Jones at the time, and I spiraled down to him and said, right, we need to slow down a bit now. And that decision meant we did 100k rather than probably a glide to deck at sort of 80k.
So tell us about the other 100k flight that you did in the southwesterly.
Okay, from members only site at the White Horse at Milk Hill. The local pilots who fly it a lot always talk about flying to Cromer from there. So it does have amazing potential from about 245k, I think, to the Norfolk coast. If anyone knows the area, you take off from the sort of Marlborough Massif, and heading in the southwesterly direction, you fly over Oxford. You clear the airspace, the Stansted airspace, on your right-hand side, and then you're pretty much into the sort of flatlands of Suffolk and Norfolk with the odd 80Z and that, but pretty much then clear for the next 150k airspace-wise all the way to the coast. So once you've done the hard work, the first 100k, getting around the London TMA, then, yeah, in the clear. So potential-wise, it's an excellent sign.
So when you did your 100k there recently, what happened?
I went to the wrong site, in my opinion. The wind was quite westerly, and in that area there are two takeoffs. There's one at Ryebury, which is a hill in front, and then there's Milk Hill with the spur, which is called the White Horse, which the local club have only just got permission to fly. I want to just mention, actually, that it's a site which the XC League is helping them to police, because the rules are quite strict. You need to pay £30 to BHPA if you want to fly for an extra £3 billion worth of insurance, top-up insurance. And you have to be a full Thames Valley member to fly. From my experience of that day, if the wind's westerly, I actually probably won't get there again. I'll probably go to Ryebury. So we sat in very rough air on the mill watching my watch. Two gaggles get away from Ryebury. The first pilot off was Dave Snowden. He unfortunately got as far as Marlborough. After that was Adrian Thomas, Mark Jones again, and Jim Mallinson. So I watched them get up, getting very frustrated at this stage, to the extent that I was seriously considering just gliding off the hill to the bottom and then sacrificing 45 minutes to walk up to Ryebury on the other side. And then the weakest of thermals came through, and I realised that we were in the wrong place, and the only way of getting up would be to take this back and fly down the ridge and hopefully get something better. And I suppose it worked. I managed to eventually get up from another site called Golden Ball, and then I was on my way. Very good conditions. Cloudburst quite low, and as you know, early on in the day, when cloudburst is low, you tend to get more abundant lift. So I managed to pick some good lines, stay high, and was planning. There's one bit of airspace in the first 30K, which is the Aldermaston prohibited area. It's around the nuclear research facility. I was helped by having done a very similar flight about a month and a half earlier. This time I decided I was going to, the airspace goes up to 2,000 feet. I decided I was going to follow my cloud street over the top of this airspace. Went on a glide towards it and hit massive sink. And was hit by a horrible realisation that I had a very good chance of sinking down into the airspace and spoiling the whole flight. So had to do a suicide push to my left, off the back of the downs, towards Wantage. Totally the wrong place to be, in the lee of the downs, and pushing against quite a strong southwesterly wind to stay clear of the airspace. And just really thought, well, this is the end of the flight. And that, so it's 600-700 foot above the ground, hit a 7-up call, and thought, well, all I can do is hang on to this and hope I don't hit the airspace on the way up. And luckily just cleared the edge of the airspace on the climb up through 2,000 feet and just missed it again on the glide out the airspace low. Yeah, unfortunately Jim and Adrian hadn't been quite so lucky, and they'd got low a little bit to the north of the airspace, and I flew over their position, then passed Didcot. I made the mistake of with Didcot before flying past Didcot. It's a, for those who don't know, it's a power station which always seems to produce good lift. The mistake I made previously was to think the clouds beyond it had their own separate source, whereas in fact the clouds are formed over Didcot and then drift downwind. So you ignore Didcot at your peril. In the middle of the flight, I got to a stage where there weren't any decent clouds ahead, and it was really a case of staying in the air, and got low, managed to find some weak bubbles in the lee of a small ridge at about 400 or 500 feet. And again, one of the benefits of modern gliders, they're very agile and stay together in rough air, and just managed to stay in the air for long enough, probably about 10 to 15 minutes of swearing and battling, for this bubble to reach another ridge in the distance and take off again. So that was the one low point. I then had another probably 15, 20k staying at cloudbase, good glides to Milton Keynes, past Milton Keynes, got to the 120k point, And I have to say, at this stage, probably I was getting a bit tired. Psychologically, I didn't know if the flight was valid because I thought there was a very good chance I had gone through the Aldermaston zone on the climb out. But I got low in the first hour and lost a bit of concentration, went on a glide to a cloud, which didn't work, and then found myself in the blue. And this time, no saving thermals low down, so landed just past Woburn Abbey.
All these flights have been sort of 3.5, 4.5 hours. How do you kind of cope, you know, in terms of your mental attitude with such long flights?
I tend to work quite hard in the first couple of climbs, really mapping out the flavour of the day. So working out if there's any shear layers, any points where you have to push more into wind to stay in the core. Working out where, in relation to the cloud, my lift is going to be. I tend to fly clouds rather than ground features. On strong wind days, you tend to find the stronger cores are upwind. Actually, both days from Lidington, the lift was on the upwind side of the clouds. So working that out early is very useful. I don't really try and work out where on the ground the thermals come from. Often on strong wind days, the angle, the drift is so great that you're not going to really be able to work out where the lift's come from if you're high up, or where the lift's going to come from if you're high up. And then having sort of made that mental plan, that makes life a lot easier 2-3 hours into the flight for your decision making. Like any aviation, you are constantly reviewing that decision and assessing. And the benefit of having flown for so many years is a lot of that decision making is now very subconscious. I make decisions, I turn 90 degrees and find a core, but if you ask me why I've done it, I really wouldn't be able to tell you. So I think that's the benefit of experience, is you sort of lock away a lot of that decision making, and it gives you the capacity to think about other things.
Do you have kind of a routine to focus on something else?
I think in the early days I should have concentrated more on that side of things. I don't fly with water, I don't fly with food, and just get on with it. I tend to take photographs when I'm on glide. From a planning point of view, I think you've always got in mind, certainly flying down south, it's a constant planning exercise as to where the airspace is. The thing that will end your flight early is if you get low downwind of airspace and in a position where you can't actually take the climb to get you up because it'll drift you into it. So it's constantly assessing. I've got instruments now which tell me what the drift is doing at various levels. So you know, approaching perhaps Southampton zone when the wind's more northerly, that early on you need to push further west from a site like Lidington or Coombe to make life easier later on. So I think when I fly, I've got sort of my immediate sort of vicinity, which is the thermal I'm in. So a lot of therming is now a subconscious thing. I don't have to think about it too much. As I'm climbing up, I'm probably looking at the sky an hour ahead from a basic navigation point of view. From a speed fly point of view, I'm looking at the next probably couple of climbs and constantly monitoring the sky ahead. If I see a cloud developing and it's sort of day where you get the best lift in the early development of a cloud, then I'll leave my climb early to get there, to get a better climb. If it's totally blue ahead and I can't see anything happening at all, then I'll sort of relax and concentrate on the climb I'm in and be a monitor, but realise that it's time to drift a bit and wait for something to develop. So, and the challenge or paradigm to me is just that. It's putting everything together for 4 or 5 hours, the sort of intellectual challenge of getting it right. It's a big aerial game of chess. What a lot of people don't realise is those 20, 30k flights are perfect preparation for 100k flights. If somebody wants to fly 100k, I suggest that they don't think about the distance, they just think about time. And for 100k, it's 4 hours in the air. And then actually one of the most important instruments to carry is a watch. But I fly with a Flytech Varia. That will actually automatically record your takeoff time and time in the air, and give you a stopwatch on the device. Well, I find that very useful. You can be flying for half an hour and feel sort of mentally exhausted, and you look down and go, well, I've only been flying for half an hour. Pull yourself together. And having that as a goal, staying in the air for 4 hours as a goal, is definitely the way to fly 100K. And the other thing that helps me is, again, on the time, from a timescale point of view, and knowing your distance from takeoff, which this flight deck does, it helps you work out your average speed. You can be flying for an hour and you can still see your takeoff hill and you can think, oh, 5 an hour, I've hardly gone anywhere. you look down, it says, oh, you've done 26 kilometres. And you think, oh, I'm doing 26 kilometres an hour. Oh, you have to stay in the air for another 4 hours. Again, it's a very motivating factor. So I'd say the most important instruments when you're flying, obviously something that beeps tells you whether you're going up or down. An averager, which is superb when you're in light lift, telling you actually overall, I'd suggest a 20-second moving average, overall whether you're winning or losing. And if you're in lift, how well you're doing in the climb as a whole, because you can go from being, you can go from a rough climb where you've got lift and sink, and you think you're doing really well, but the average only says three up, to smoother lift that doesn't feel so dynamic, and the average will actually be higher. Next most important thing I'd say is something that tells you your distance from takeoff, and then the time you've been in the air. But it's difficult to fly 100k from a site you've never been to before, or you've never really planned to do 100k from before. If you fly long wind enough, and you've done 30, 40k flights, you've effectively already mapped out the first hour or 2 hours of your 100k flight, and then it's just a case of putting it all together. I was benefited from the flight from Longmin, because I've flown Longmin a lot before and knew and had quite a lot of local knowledge. The 100k flight from the White Horse, I've previously, a month and a half before, done the 60k flight from there, so I learned from quite a few mistakes I've done from that flight. The flights from Lidington, I've done a 98k flight from Lidington, and you do have the satisfaction of flying over Coombe Gibbet from Lidington. So I've done flights from Coombe before, so you know, a lot of big distance flying is just doing what you've done before for a little bit longer. I would suggest anyone wanting a big flight, they sit down the night before, phone the free phone number, find out what extra airspace is on. Both the flights from Lidington and Farnborough is on, so there's actually a very small gap to get through between Farnborough airspace and Southampton airspace. That took quite a lot of planning, so you can phone the free phone temporary airspace number and get the next day's information from about 6 o'clock in the evening from the previous day, and that helps the planning process. Sit down and have a good look at the half of the map. Even if you are flying with a GPS with a moving map display, you still need a bigger picture that will tell you when you're in the air for basic planning. And it's always a good idea to put a couple of waypoints in your GPS, which will help you get around airspace, so you've got something to head for when you're in the air.
In your 17 years of flying, what are your top tips?
First one given to me by a late hang glider pilot in the Wessex Club called Steve Adams. In the early days of paragliding, there was just myself and friend Neil Hutchison flying paragliders. And the hang glider pilots ruled the roost. They regularly flew from our sites to the coast. And in my frustration one day, I said, Steve, how do you do this? What are you doing? And he said, that's very simple. I just circle and lift, fly straight and sink. And gliding paragliders is really as simple as that. The second lesson I've learnt from countless mistakes myself is that paragliders are very bad at crossing blue holes. It's worth flying 45 degrees off track to stay in lines of lift under clouds rather than trying to take a shortcut across a blue hole. Yeah, and the other thing, it sounds strange, but it's also something you've got to want to do. You do need to dedicate the whole day to a big flight. The retrieve from Chichester was a gentleman's experience. We landed in a golf course and went and had a beer, took a taxi train ride and a taxi back to the hill. But it took 6 hours and I didn't get home till 11 o'clock in the evening. So you do have to be able to dedicate the whole day to do the big flight on a paraglider. If you've got any distractions at all, if you need to pick the kids up from school at 3 o'clock or be back from dinner party at 7, then it's just not going to happen.
Have you got any other tips or observations?
I suppose one is that the window of opportunity of getting away from UK sites is often very, very small. My first flight from Lidington, I'd been to Coombe Gibbet, which is site about 25k to the south previously, realised that the wind was well off to the west and it was quite windy, so chose to drive to Lidington. Thought I'd blown it because there was high cloud coming in from the north and it was already starting to encroach on the side. I arrived there with two other good pilots, Sean Cunningham and Johnny Groves, and the difference is I rigged at the bottom of the hill and then used the wing to tow me up the hill. They walked up the hill and rigged, and the difference of 5 minutes made all the difference. There was half a thermal before the high cloud came and shut everything off, and I was lucky enough to be in the air ready for it while they were still getting ready. Unfortunately, on some of the biggest hills in the UK, you often get only one or even only half a chance of getting up, and you just have to be clipped in and ready to take that opportunity. Yeah, lots of pilots arrive on the hill and get their packed luggage out. And fine, if all you want to do is ridge saw and stay on the hill, fine. But you might find that there is only one thermal, and it goes through as you're just packing your lunch up. And again, this is something I've learned from bitter experience about not being ready and realising just how fleeting some of the chances you get are. And it is often the people who get away first who have the best flights. It's not the same necessarily in competitions where you actually benefit from having lots of people in front of you. But in the UK, I very seldom push back from a climb. If I'm in a climb and it's going, I tend to take it.
Any other observations?
Don't beat yourself up over it. We can all get far too serious about what is still it's a fun sport. If you do a 20-30k flight and it's a 100k day, you've still gained a massive amount of experience in that 20-30k, which you'll amass subconsciously. It'll be there for next time. And every dog has his day. But it's putting the frustrations and disappointments behind you and realising there will be another day, there will be another post-cold frontal northwesterly and another chance to fly to the coast.
Well, you said earlier that the wings that we fly these days have just got so much better. What wing do you fly?
I fly a Gradient Avax XE2, so it's the sort of latest breed of, it's actually a SEN-C glider, very stable, glide around about 9.5 to 1. I was very lucky in the early days to get support from Greg Nicholas at Gradient, and I like the gliders so much, I even sell them myself now. So I've found a brand of glider I enjoy flying, and luckily for me, they haven't produced a dud one yet. They keep producing wings which work, so I've stuck with them. And this year's gliders are absolutely fantastic.
On that note, many, many thanks.